Is it go time?
Yeah, I'll tell you in a second. I just want to make sure you're ready for it to go.
We're ready anytime.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the House Interim Committee on Human Services. And colleagues, we have a very interesting program, starting with what I think will be one of the most interesting of the day. And it has to do with traumatic brain injury. And you may remember that we all agreed. Am I?
What is that sound?
Oh.
The equipment.
Okay, sometimes we have a little
feedback.
Audio feedback, and she's checking on it right now. I'm going to turn this over to a very good friend of mine, Sherry Stock. Before I do, I want to remind people on the dais and people with us listening at home, millions of viewers, and those of you in the room with us today, thank you for being here, that this young lady is an incredible Oregonian. She's the executive director of the Brain Injury Alliance of Oregon. And she's also a member of several boards that the governor has appointed her to over the years. And I won't read the whole list, but you know how when you say sometimes about somebody, why that person wrote the book on, I could say that about you on a couple of things. Sherry has actually written the handbook on traumatic brain injury. She's that good. And I'm really glad she's here. I need everybody here, and thank goodness you're here, Representative Harker, to be participatory, and Sherry will explain that. But we're going to have a part of this, and it'll require us to get up out of our seats and be part of this, and I hope you'll all participate.
Sure.
With that, we open the informational meeting on traumatic brain injury and disability simulation, and Sherry, I'll start with you, and you get us kicked off.
So, Chair Gilliam and Tomei and committee members, I want to thank you for allowing us to come. What this presentation is going to do...
And even though I said your name, Sherry, I need you to identify...
And my name is Sherry Stock. I'm the Executive Director of the Brain Injury Alliance of Oregon, mother of a severely brain-injured son, so I can walk the walk and talk the talk. But I'm also a neurogerontologist, so my specialty is aging and Alzheimer's. And I have to say that I came here to Oregon because of Mitch Greenlick and his Kaiser Center for Health Research. Didn't get a job there, but that's why I came. But anyway, beside the point. So what we're doing today is to let you experience what people with disabilities, all disabilities, are experiencing before they go into the workforce or in the workforce. And this, what I partner with Selina Miller at Oregon Voc Rehab and Linda Van Doren from the Commission for the Blind. And this show that we're going to do with you and to you is we do this throughout the state. We do it for, we've done it for the Fish and Wildlife, for the Forest Service, for various businesses around the states. We've done it to state departments. We've done it to with. Who else?
Legacy.
So anyone that would employ someone with a disability or have someone with a disability employed is fair game for us. And we enjoy this. I hope you enjoy this, too. You should have quite a few aha moments. And know that you're not going to be able to do what we ask you to do, and that's just the point. So I'm going to turn this over to Selina now.
Are you going to do the faces, though?
Not until it's my time.
Oh. Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Selina Miller, and I'm with the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, Department of Human Services. And let's start with what is in front of you, disability awareness training agenda. Looks like this.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, people with disability, there's about 54 million people with disabilities in the United States. This is since the last census. And 30 million of them are between the ages of 20 and 45. So that's really prime, working life age. One in five is a person with a disability. One in five people would be a person with a disability in the United States. And, of course, the greatest societal barrier to people with disabilities is attitudinal. It's how we feel about folks and treat folks, and hopefully respectfully. And that's one of the major barriers for a person with a disability. Sensitivity towards people with disabilities makes good business sense. They have over $1 trillion worth of expendable income. So for a business, that's a lot of money that they can get from it. But disabilities can be obvious and or hidden. It's estimated that 60% of a person of disability is hidden. We don't see it. You may see somebody with a wheelchair or someone using sign language, but the majority of them, you know, brain injury, it's hidden. You don't see them. An unemployment rate of people with disabilities is about 15.7%. That is compared to approximately 8% in the non-disability world. So that's nearly double the unemployment rate for people with disabilities. And the average cost for accommodation is around $600. And very often, the least expensive form of accommodation in the workplace is the flexible work schedule, you know, starting and stop time, when they can work, when they can start and rest. So a flexible work schedule, really, it doesn't cost very much for an employer. So with just a few of those statistics about people with disabilities, we're going to have Sherry now start with the hidden disability.
Okay, so when we're talking about a hidden disability, usually when I talk about a hidden disability, I'm talking about a brain injury, which affects about 17,000 Oregonians every year. But when we talk about a hidden disability, we're talking about anything that affects a disability is anything that affects your activities of daily living. So do you need accommodations in daily living? Now, I can see that most of us in this room are using some accommodations, so that's eyeglasses. With these accommodations, we can get along fine. If we didn't have these eyeglasses, we might have a problem that would interfere with our activities of daily living. The number one hidden disability in the workforce is arthritis. We're an aging society, so that is over 52% of the workforce has some form of arthritis. Number two are back injuries, and which is nearly 39% of all the workforce has a back injury that causes issues periodically. And there's other disabilities might be being deaf, being blind, being in a wheelchair. Those are obvious. But having maybe attention deficit or ADD, ADHD, usually those are linked to some sort of a brain injury. You might have mental illness. There's all sorts of different disabilities that you don't even think about that people are dealing with. And when I talk about disability, I like to mention some of the people that have disabilities, some of the people that you will know since you're not in the Forest Service anyway. I have to say, when I listed these with the Forest Service, not one single person, one of these that I'm going to mention, they knew about. So, hold on.
Was it the U.S. or the State Forester?
U.S. Forest Service. So they do not go to the movies, by the way, so they don't know anything. So George Clooney has a brain injury. George Clooney sustained a brain injury in filming Syriana. Has anybody seen that movie? So there's a scene in there where he's being interrogated, and they kick over the chair. His head bounced one time. They did that scene one time. That tore the dura, so the fluid that goes around his brain and the spinal cord was leaking out. And it was a year before the headache subsided enough that he could even go back to work. And he first started talking about it, and the script stopped coming, so then he stopped talking about it, and the script started coming again. He still has an issue, and he's starting to talk about it more because he's gotten it more under control, but he has severe headaches. Judy Garland. Judy Garland was a singer, actress, entertainer. She's severe depression and alcoholism. She also, the very famous movie, probably the most famous movie on brain injury, and that was The Wizard of Oz. Jason Alexander is in Seinfeld. He has asthma. Tom Cruise is an actor, so you're not in the Forest Service, so you probably know who that is. He is has a learning disability. His learning disability is so severe, he can't read a script. He has someone that reads it to him. He can memorize almost instantly, but he can't read a script. Danny Glover is a local man, lives here in Portland, and he has epilepsy. Halle Berry has diabetes. Diabetes is on the rise. We eat so healthy anymore that diabetes is increasing from infancy up. Lou Ferrigno, this is the only one the Forest Service knew. Lou Ferrigno has a hearing impairment. And
the Hulk.
He played the Hulk.
He's the Green Man.
Henry Winkler has a learning disability. Marilyn Monroe suffered from depression. James Earl Jones, he has a speech impediment. That fabulous voice for Darth Vader is because of his speech impediment. Carrie Fisher has learning disabilities and depression. And Edgar Allan Poe, probably one of the most famous authors with severe disability, was severely bipolar, and his most famous works were written while he was having his manic bipolar episodes. And with brain injury affects about 2 million people each year sustain a brain injury. Every 15 seconds, someone sustains a brain injury. If you add in stroke, which stroke is increasing, babies are having strokes from birth on, didn't used to do, at least we didn't weren't aware they were having them. And so if you add in stroke, it's about every 3 minutes someone in this country has a stroke or a brain injury. It's a fourth leading cause overall and in death, and it's the number one cause of childhood death. And it's rising in with seniors. As seniors age, we have more seniors aging. We're living longer. Actually, we're living as long as we ever have. More people are living longer. And having balance issues and falling is the number one. Most people that fall, when they're older, if they hit their head, they usually die. Younger people, children, 0 to 4, all of us have fallen and hit our heads. All of us have sustained some sort of brain injury. Did it impact your everyday living? Probably not, because you wouldn't be here, but it does impact a lot of people's. And a study in England found out that 87% of all children that were diagnosed as ADD or ADHD actually had a traumatic brain injury, and that's what was causing the issues. And PTSD and TBI are the signature injuries are returning veterans, and right now the government is admitting to a third have some sort of PTSD or traumatic brain injury. So we're looking at a minimum of 450,000 servicemen that have served in Iraq and Afghanistan having those issues, and we're already seeing the results of that. So spousal abuse has increased, suicide, various crimes, child abuse, everything is on the increase because of this. And so one of the things I want to do is I want to talk about some of the issues that people can have with this learning disability. They might have a hard time sitting still. And you might have some constituents that come in and display this. They might be unable to read, or they don't want to read something. You give them something and they're going to look at it later. That would be a red flag. They're unable to hear and understand the words that are going on in the room. And maybe things are overwhelming to them. They find it difficult to concentrate and have a hard time answering questions. If you ask them a question, they don't have a response right away. They might get lost in their conversation. And all of these are indicative of some sort of hidden disability. So to show you what it might be like to have the inability to maybe recognize a face, we're going to play a little game. And so what I'm going to do is ask you not to tilt your head upside down, but to try to recognize who these faces are. Which one is it? So does anybody recognize who these faces are?
No.
Mr. Clinton.
Do you ready?
Wow, good job.
So, Princess Diana.
Vic Gilliam.
Still don't recognize him.
Didn't even recognize himself.
That's all the time we have.
But what this illustrates is, the truth is, no one can see, recognize a face upside down. But some people, it doesn't matter if they're seeing them upside down or right side up, they don't recognize anyone. I ran into, because I specialize in brain injury, I'm a hammer and everybody's a nail. So I run into brain injury all the time. But I was had an hour to spare, so best thing to do with an hour to spare is go shopping. So the young woman that I met at the store that was checking me out repeated herself two or three times, so I just started casually talking to her, and it turned out she had a brain injury. She's had this job for 3 weeks. Voc Rehab got her this job, and she doesn't recognize faces, and so she doesn't know who her boss is. She knows her boss's name is Nancy, but she has no idea. She cannot remember if she's short, tall, skinny, fat. Can't recognize a face, doesn't know what color hair she has. She knows her name is Nancy. And so she says, so I just call everybody Nancy. And I said, you know, you could just say, hey girl, or figure out some little word that you use to call everybody the same name. You know, there's nothing that's going to help that. What I told her is there are some strategies you can use, like take everybody's picture and put it into your iPhone with a name, so then you could go and look it up. But, it, you know, her life is not going to change. She's never going to recognize faces. But now we come to a fun part. I want to do a little simulation. So I'm going to ask all of you to come down in front and bring a pen or a pencil. And Cheyenne, you're going to come too.
Are we bringing this also?
No paper.
No, you're just not. That's
just a
pencil or paper.
So what you're going to do is bring, I guess I kind of have to.
You can put that up.
I can put this up. So what I'm going to ask is each of you to stand around in a circle.
One circle, two circles.
One circle?
Yes, get in a tight little circle. I'm going to have to sit down and do this.
Two circles, one.
So everybody has a pen. Just need one pen, nothing else in your hand. You're going to get in a circle.
Make it round.
Round circle. Okay, so now I'm going to ask you questions. You can move just a tight little bit further apart. I'm going to ask you questions about this story. So when I ask you questions, make sure you listen to the story so you can answer the questions. Okay, and when I say the word right, you're going to pass to the right. And when I say the word left, pass to the left. So the pen or pencil in your hand. When I say the word right, to the right, to the left. Okay? Right, right, left, left. If anything happens, just keep going. Right goes to the right, left goes to the left. One day, the Wright family decided to take a vacation. The first thing they had to decide was who's going to be left at home, since there was not enough room in the Wright family car for all of them. Mr. Wright decided that Aunt Linda Wright would be left at home. So, of course, this made Aunt Linda Wright so mad she left the Wright house yelling, "It'll be a Wright cold day before she returns." The Wright family now bundled up the children, Tommy Wright, Susan Wright, Timmy Wright, and Shelley Wright, and got into the Wright family car and left. Unfortunately, as they left out of the driveway, someone had left the trash can in the street, so they had to turn right around to stop the car. They told Tommy Wright to get out of the car and move the trash can so they could get going. Tommy Wright took so long, Aunt Linda left him in the street. Once the Wright family got on the road, Mother Wright wondered if she had left the stove on. Father Wright told her not to worry, so he would check the stove, and she had not left it on. As they turned right at the corner, everyone started to think about things they had left undone. No need to worry now. They were off on a Wright fine vacation. When they arrived at the gas station, Father Wright put gas in the car and then discovered he had left his wallet at home. So Timmy Wright ran home to get the money. After Timmy left, Susan Wright started to feel sick, so she left the car saying that she had to throw up. This, of course, got Mother Wright's attention, and she left the car in a hurry. Shelley Wright wanted to watch Susan Wright get sick, so she left the car too. Father Wright was left with Tommy Wright, who was playing in the back seat. With all of this going on, Father Wright decided it was not the right time to take a family vacation. He gathered up the Wright family and left the gas station as quickly as he could. When he arrived home, he turned left into the driveway and said, "I wish the Wright family had never left home today." Okay, now you can go back to your seats and we'll talk about this.
Here are your pens.
Oh, yeah. Does anybody want their pen or pencil back?
This is sort of where I
screwed that all up. Couldn't pass pens fast enough.
So, how many children were in the Wright family?
Who knows?
A boy and a girl for sure, maybe a third kid.
The right amount.
So there were four.
Four on the left.
And what were their names?
Bobby.
Tommy Wright.
Yeah.
All right, hey, look at you, smarty pants.
That's going.
So there was Tommy, Susan, Timmy, and Shelley. Who was left at home at the beginning of the story?
Tommy Wright.
Aunt Linda.
Aunt Linda.
Which child ran home to get the money?
That was your Tommy. He went home and got money.
That was Timmy. And which child got sick at the gas station? So that was Susan. So what this illustrates, and I know I was going fast, but someone with a brain injury, this is what they experience all the time. If you ask them to do more than one thing at a time, they're overwhelmed. And these returning veterans that have PTSD, TBI, this is what they're going through. If anybody asks them to do more than one thing at a time, they can't because everything's all mixed up. And so there are strategies, there's different adaptations you can get, different things you can get for your cell phone that can help you, timers, because you're not going to remember the time to do things. And some people can't remember their kids. What you have in front of you is also a DVD that I made for you this morning. And this is the Gabby Gifford story. And in it is, it's real short, it's about 30 minutes total, but I've divided it into five sections. And the first section talks about not only her brain injury and what she's experiencing and how she's adapting, but also a lot of other famous people and what they've gone through and how they've come through it, but what they went through, so you can see what they went through.
Including the narrator. Correct?
Yeah. So Bob Woodruff talks a little bit about his injury in Iraq and what he went through, how he couldn't remember his kids' names, couldn't remember that he had kids, and how he came back. And a lot of that is new memories. So they really did, that part of their memory is gone. With Congresswoman Giffords, who it's surprised that she even lived, to be honest with you, what she did is she learned to speak again by singing. Because the singing is on, and it talks about this, but the right side of the brain, she was damaged on the left side that has really the speech centers, and those were damaged, but by singing, she was able to retrain her brain. And so we're learning things all the time. It's in the newspaper every single day now. They've now got little computer chips they can put in that will help. And that was in the newspaper 2 days ago. But every single day, there's something on brain injury in the paper, especially with returning veterans. So now we're going to go to hearing.
So actually, it's vision.
Actually,
Actually, it's vision. Good afternoon. I'm Linda Van Doren. I'm the Business Relations Coordinator for the Commission for the Blind. My job is to outreach, educate, and employ our consumers. But I outreach to business and partner with business and dispel myths around people who have vision loss and what they can and cannot do in the workplace. So I'm going to tell you a few stats. So each year, about 1,900 people become legally blind here in Oregon. An estimated 19,220 Oregonians are blind currently. By the way, I have to put on my assistive technology so I can read properly. Unemployment for individuals who are blind approaches 70%. We heard the other statistics, about 8.5% for those who without disabilities, 17% for the overall disability world, but 70% for those who are legally blind. So 35% of individuals over the age of 65 will experience some vision loss. And currently, vision loss, there's an epidemic of diabetes. So with diabetes comes many disabilities, one of them being vision loss. Other age-related macular degeneration, cataracts, strokes, all of those things can create vision loss. So the Oregon Commission for the Blind's job placement statistics for 2010 are we had about 100 positive closures last year. And I wanted to read to you the percentages in what categories of employment. I think it's very interesting. 20% were employed in education and social services, 18% were in office and clerical, 15% in sales occupations, 15% in healthcare occupations, 11% in professional and managerial, 7% in computer and math, 5% in art, design, and sports, 5% in food prep and production, and 4% in other categories. So I have a simulation also that I'd like you to participate in, and we're passing out some visual simulators. And those of you who are using adaptive technology, such as glasses, if you have really poor eyesight, you can just take them off. But I'd appreciate it if you would look through these simulators, because what they do is simulate different eye conditions for people who I'm trying to place. So the Commission for the Blind, I think, is one of the best-kept secrets in Oregon. We have a technology center. We do mobility training, independent living training. But we are a rehabilitation program, and we want to put people back to work. That's our mission. So
you're ready for us to put them on?
Yes, put those on, please. So while you have these on, I want you to think about how you're going to do your current job. With these simulators, now these are real eye conditions. So think about it. Can you drive here? Can you access your computer without assistive technology? Can you get from this room?
I see him taking pictures back there. That's
I know. No fair.
I know.
Can you find the right color of clothing to match? Can you cook and clean? Can you do all of those things that you do daily? But the most important is thinking about how you would do your job and what assistive technology you would need to do your job. So I have a volunteer, I understand, is Representative Gilliam. He's going to come down here, and we're going to do another simulation. You can leave that there. I have something else for you. So I'll try to stay on the mic, but maybe I can carry it around.
Okay.
So would you put these on, please?
Sure.
These are called night shades or blackout shades. Unfortunately, this cane is not your size, but you're going to have to use it anyway. So today, I'm going to ask that you, can you see anything?
I can see a little light here, and that's it.
Okay, that's fine. So today I'm going to manipulate you around the room a little bit, and then I'm going to ask you to find your way back here, just using your cane, and let me demonstrate a little bit how you might use a cane. You don't tap like this. You do this.
Sweeping motion.
Okay. Okay. All right, so I'm going to give you sighted guide for a minute, so that is like this.
Okay.
So come with me.
Not down the stairs.
Quite fast.
You're quite fast.
Okay, so if you are an individual who is looking for a job and you are going to go to the Oregon Employment Department, one of their field offices, and go in and ask to sit down to a computer that has JAWS on it, because you're going to use JAWS because you can't see anything, so it's a voice-activated technology, and you're going to be looking for a job. So you're going to experience possibly how you would get into the room, how you would get assistance, that kind of thing. So all right, you're on your own.
My goal is to go back.
Your goal is to come back to the front of the room.
Okay.
And I'll go up front so you can follow my voice, and that way it won't be as difficult. How's that?
Okay.
Okay. I'm doing good. Oh, we need to put the cane on the ground and on the floor.
Or lower.
Yeah, keep it on the floor. Otherwise, you might poke somebody. So we're going to pretend like you just came through the doors of the workforce office.
Oh, Jen, don't do that.
You're doing pretty well.
My goal is to find this seat.
You're gonna find me, actually, and then you can take off.
Which would be like.
Well, good afternoon. Could I help you?
Yes, I'd like to apply.
Apply for what?
Job opening.
Okay. Great. Well, let me see if I can get someone to assist you.
Oh, thank you.
So now you can take off your simulators. And the simulation is over.
So yeah, he actually did better with the blinders than he does without them.
That's right.
Well, so thank you for participating. Right. So I just want you to, well, you can get up and go back to your seat, but I'd like for you to explain what that felt like, maybe.
Well, you do feel very vulnerable, and then when you added part, don't swing the cane, you realize that, you know, I could be of some danger to someone else. So that added to my anxiety. And then you begin immediately to try to rely on your ears.
Mm-hmm.
Your voice was very important. I probably would have headed that way or something.
Right. Well, that's just a little, and you can see those with those simulators that you all put on and experienced, you can see the challenges that people with low vision, blindness has in getting a job. But we make it happen. As I said, we had, 100 successful closures last year, and there are many challenges, but people are willing. People want to go to work, and they are willing. But this is so good that you were able to do this because of the importance of understanding.
When you say closure, you mean connecting someone with an
opportunity. Employment.
Yeah, good.
Yes. Do you have any questions about that? Anyone else with the...
That's interesting. There are 70 people employed a year, but there are 1,900 a year who become blind.
Yes.
That's a very tiny percentage.
It is.
So the 17, if I may...
Please.
1,900. I can't read my writing. But are all of those employable age, or are those people who, a percentage of them are maybe retired? I was thinking my father had glaucoma and he did
right.
become...
That's blind. Across the age gamut, yes.
So what proportion of people who are in the, say, before 65 would become blind? How many?
You know, I don't have that statistic.
Okay, I'm just wondering.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
But your dad.
Yeah,
illustrate the intake.
Oh, one of the illustrations I wanted to pass on is a gentleman, an engineer from Intel. He had his job before he came to the Commission for the Blind. He was a software engineer. He was also a climber, and he was climbing on Mount Hood. I believe it was Mount Hood, and he fell. And he hit the back of his head and became instantly blind. He also suffered a traumatic brain injury. So now he has a brain injury and he is blind. And he came to the commission. He was determined to go back to work, and he did. He went back to Intel to the same job he had before, but he didn't. He said to me he couldn't do that without the help of the Commission for the Blind. He had to learn mobility skills. He had to learn assistive technology. He had to learn independent living skills. He had to learn his life all over again, and he's been very successful. He's one that. We're just proud to serve, and he told me I could use him as an example. So, but there are many others. Some people, when they come to us, they don't want to go to work. We have the older blind program, so they can just access, you know, independent living skills. They can come and learn Braille if they want. We have a center where people come and stay for 6 months. Excuse me, 90 days, I'll get it right, and take classes. And, you know, some people who are older don't want to return to work. They just, you know, get those individual services that they want. But again, I said we're after, you know, we are a rehab agency, and we do really assist people going back to work. So thank you. Selena?
So I have the next part, and that is of hearing. Are my notes here? There's about 17 million people with hearing problems, with a significant hearing problem, and most of them work. Most of them can be accommodated with the different technology, as well as, you know, using sign language, or the technology has increased so much that accommodation has been fairly easy for people with deaf. But what you have in front of you is an unfair hearing test. It's got three columns on it. If you could find that.
Mm-hmm. Pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're going to play a tape, and the sounds, you'll hear the list of words. Write down the words that you hear, that you can hear. If you can't hear it, that's okay. You can skip. There'll be 10 words in the first column A, and then we'll go to column B, and we'll go to column C. Everybody ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Not play.
There's no sound.
I'm not hearing anything.
You skipped that one.
Bad hearing problem. We're not hearing anything.
It's a serious hearing problem.
So we have to have AV come, sorry. So we'll get this fixed as soon as we can.
I hear it just fine. You guys can't hear it?
Another thing while we're waiting for AV to come and fix this, one of the we don't do any of this in a vacuum. There are nonprofits and state agencies across the state that we work with. And we work, both Salina and Linda are a part of the Office of Department of Rehabilitation. And under the Department of Rehabilitation, so I have a form here with the blue that tells you what Voc Rehab does. And so besides basic vocational rehabilitation services, they supported employment services, a youth transition program, independent living program. The independent living centers are part of a chain that's federally funded and state funded. And right now we have 7 centers in the state. These centers have 9 locations, and they serve anyone and everyone with a disability. And they turn no one away, and they don't ask for any funding whatsoever. And that services might include support groups, peer mentored or staff run support groups. It might be job training. It might be giving them some basic training to maybe balance their checkbook, or to cook, to learn an instrument. And so it's all different types of disabilities. And what the form in front of you also shows is how many people and were served and cases closed on the back of the form and this was done in a recession too, and the average wage, and as you'll see, the average wage is all of them above average wage. And so that this is a phenomenal program that we have a lot to be proud of here in Oregon. We also work with other nonprofits. The Brain Injury Association isn't the only nonprofit they work with. They work with the ARC and FACT, which is Family Advocacy and Community Training in the Portland area. And
what does ARC stand for, Sherry?
Huh?
ARC stands for?
Well, ARC used to stand for Association of Retarded Citizens, but that's so PC not that it now just stands for ARC. So they had predominantly developmentally disabled, which means an under 70 IQ. So it's not uncommon for, say, a child that sustains a brain injury. When you sustain a brain injury, it doesn't affect your intelligence. It just affects how you can tap into that. But if you sustain it young enough, then it's very difficult to learn, or you might not be able to learn at all. So children that sustain a brain injury young, even though they're not developmentally disabled, they, in the state of Oregon, are considered developmentally disabled because they have an under 70 IQ.
Sherry, would you repeat that about not affecting your intelligence?
Yeah, so with Gabby Giffords. So her gunshot wound, which was severe, I mean, it went in the left side of her forehead and came out the back of her head and just above the occipital lobe, so it didn't affect her vision, but it went through the two areas of speech. And so she shouldn't have been able to speak. She's just as intelligent as she ever was. What's interesting with Congresswoman Giffords is it didn't affect her personality. And a lot of people, my associate director is an attorney that was in a rollover automobile accident. And she was not able to go back to work, and she went to voc rehab. They sent her to cognitive rehab. She is now a job coach and going through voc rehab and works for us. And Jerry used to be very detailed and very very obsessive compulsive. Everything had a place, and she was an introvert. Now she's an extrovert. She's scattered, and she's a pack rat and has no idea where anything is. So total personality change, which is not uncommon with a brain injury. But the intelligence is the same. She's still as intelligent as she ever was. And if she's not under stress, she can tap into what she knows legally with law. So she does a lot of work for us as in the legal profession, but it's not anything that there's any pressure for.
Are we ready?
Try it now?
Yeah.
Are you guys ready?
Okay. Back to column A.
Number one, fall.
Okay.
Number two, cough. Number three, thumb. Number four, heat. Number five, rise. Number six, legs. Number seven, fish. Number eight, shows. Number nine, bed. Number ten, teeth. Number one, fill.
Hey.
Wow.
Okay. Now, column B.
Number one, fill. Number two, catch. Number three, thumb. Number four, heap. Number five, wise. Number six, wedge. Number seven, fish. Number eight, shows. Number nine, bed. Number ten, juice. Number one.
Okay. Why is it doing that?
I don't know.
Okay.
Number one, fill. Number two, catch. Number three, thumb. Number four, heap. Number five, wise. Number six, wedge. Number seven, fish. Number eight, shows. Number nine, bed. Number ten, juice.
Okay, did you get it all?
They were the same all the way through.
It was the same all the way. It's just that the sound can do. So,
I could pick up, it was kind of weird, you could pick up some of the words and everything, like on the first one. But I couldn't understand it. I heard the numbers loud and clear
right. When
she would say them.
Okay.
But it's like it sounded like she's slurring some of the words. But they were the same, A, B, and C.
Exactly. Same words, yes. Yeah. Well, the first time you hear the words on column A, that's one that someone would hear without the high-pitched sounds that have been taken out. And this is how words sound to people who have a sensorineural hearing problems. And a sensorineural hearing problems is caused by a problem in the inner ear, the cranial nerve, or damage in the brain. So, and this is caused by a prolonged high fever, or a birth defect, or an injury, in the head, or even an infectious disease. And sometimes it's also hereditary. So that's what it sounds like to a person with that. On column B, with the pitch of the normal, but the volume will be low, and that's similar to have someone who has a conductive hearing problem. And that's caused by a problem in the outer or middle ear. Oftentimes it's an allergy, or you had a cold and you feel like, you know, your head is all clogged up and you can't hear through because of the cold in your head. So that's what a blocked, like conductive hearing loss. That's what it sounds like to somebody with that. The last column is one for somebody that has a fitted hearing aid. Now, I think it's because of the sound in the room. It should have been a little bit louder, but the words should be much more clear because of the hearing aid that's been fitted well to a person with a normal hearing. So do you want to hear what the words were?
Yes.
Okay. Forgot. Number one, fill. F-I-L-L. Two, catch. C-A-T-C-H. Three, thumb. T-H-U-M-B. Four, heap. H-E-A-P. Five, wise. W-I-S-E. Six, wedge, W-E-D-G-E. Seven, fish, F-I-S-H. Eight, shows, S-H-O-W-S. Nine, bed, B-E-D. 10, juice, J-U-I-C-E. Okay.
I got less than half of them in the C.
Got half.
My own hearing problem.
All of them, right?
Three. Mm-hmm. Two. In anyone call? Okay.
Seven.
I got 9 to 9 right all the way across. That was the only one.
You got all of them right in each column?
No. That was number nine. I got that one right.
I did too, all the way across.
Well, three.
Okay.
That was the only win.
Huh?
So we're going to show a movie, and this movie is a little bit dated, and you're welcome to laugh, but it's about people with disabilities, and it's, you know, recognizing that they're just like you or me. But before we start the movie, because it would be surprising if we didn't have a few problems with it anyway, I wanted to mention that there's a number of services for putting people, and you can see now with what you've gone through that it can be difficult if you have a disability to get back to work, to get a job. And we have in the state, we had a Medicaid infrastructure grant that funded, I think we had 13, and all of you, I think, have heard about this, but they were WIN counselors. That's Work Incentive Network counselors. And what they would do is look at the services you were getting, whether that be SSI or SSDI, Social Security Disability, and see if they could help you identify a way to get off or taper down your federal funding assistance or state funding assistance and move into a job. And it would cover you with medical, even through Social Security, for 5 years so that you could see if you could be successful and you could become a working member. Because one of the things with SSDI or SSI is you're in poverty and you don't get out of poverty at that level. It's not there to make you rich by any means. And so that service has been taken over by Voc Rehab right now because the funds have run out on a federal level. But they've helped hundreds of people find employment, and they're now working, paying into the tax system. And yeah, the movie. So I think we'll try the movie here.
Do
While she's getting that ready, I wanted to just mention some of the wonderful business partners that we work with. We do assessments or work experience with employers to try out jobs before people actually hired. And some of those partners have gone ahead and then hired our consumers. So some of those employers are New Seasons, Lowe's, Redmond's, Legacy, Northwest Gas, all of those.
Of so, communicating with people with disabilities. For the 10 to start, press enter now. Specific
production. Our view fades up on a well-furnished executive office suite. The video production crew waiting for instructions. The director rises.
Okay, people, listen up. Now, the camera's going to follow him right through here.
This part is usually pretty soft, and then the sound will kick up.
This one. Don't post videos every day. But please, just relax. Say hello. Make him feel welcome. Okay, here he comes. Act natural, be friendly, and roll tape.
The crew begins to work while a man and woman try to catch a glimpse of host Tim Harrington, who's walking down the hall with a slightly irregular gait. He enters the office.
Hi, everybody.
The man and woman react with uncertainty to the executive cerebral palsy.
Who are you expecting, Donald Trump?
Man approaches and shakes Tim's hand.
I'm glad to meet you. Hi, Tim Harrington.
We love you. Stand back, everyone. Is everything okay? What will you be talking about in there?
Actually, about how to communicate with people with disabilities.
Did you think of that all by yourself? Oh, that's so wonderful.
You really need to see this video. Really.
Tim enters his office. He's dressed in suit and tie, carrying a briefcase.
Like 200 times. I wish I was Donald Trump. Imagine when I could pay myself to host this video.
He sits behind his desk in a leather chair.
Is this okay?
Director and crew
enter office.
Yes, that'll
be fine. Sorry about that out there.
It's okay. Let me just try this.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Tim Harrington, living proof that America's workplace is changing. More and more, America's 49 million citizens with disabilities are getting an opportunity to show their abilities in regular mainstream jobs. That's a lot of new talent coming in. But the key to realizing that talent is creating an environment on the job and off that lets that talent flourish, just like anyone else.
Oops.
All we're asking for is a little common sense, common courtesy, and you have a few things to keep in mind. That's why we're calling this show Simple Respect, 10 Easy Tips, right?
The director offers new script.
About the title, the producers decided we needed something a little more dramatic. So they came up with something new.
Oh, really? Like what?
Graphic of Roman numeral 10. Rendered in stone appears. The title reads, The Ten Commandments of Communicating with People with Disabilities.
The Ten Commandments? Do you think I'm Charlton Heston?
No, you're still Tim Harrington.
You're sure?
Yes.
All right.
Tim turns to face camera again.
You know, if anyone out there feels a little uncomfortable with me as host, it's okay. In fact, it's natural to feel a little uncomfortable with people in situations you're not familiar with.
Views of people with disabilities.
But today, you'll be getting to know a number of people who, well, they're different from you and from me, at least in some ways, but they're just like us in others. You'll see the kinds of situations these people face every day and get some tips. Okay, commandments on how we can all help.
Good.
Okay, now we go to the first commandment?
Yep.
We have to?
Yep. It's written in stone.
Lightning flashes as a graphic of Roman numeral 1 drops into view.
Commandment number 1. Speak directly to the person rather than through a companion or sign language interpreter.
Law student Marcia Nippert through interpreter.
This happens a lot in the deaf community because others feel like deaf people are not approachable.
Colleague enters Marcia's office and interacts only with the interpreter.
Here. Report she wanted last month.
Oh, thank you a lot, Matt.
Ask her if she wants any copies of that.
No, not
one. No, not right now.
Oh, great. Tell her, good to see her again.
Marcia is displeased with being slighted.
I think it's very important when speaking to a deaf person to maintain direct contact because the deaf person is used to direct contact, which is a part of the deaf culture. When they talk, they speak to each other through their eyes.
This time, Marcia's colleague interacted directly with her instead of the interpreter.
Speaking face-to-face is the most personal means of communication there is. Someone shouldn't be excluded from that direct contact just because they have a disability. And this is a problem for a lot of people with disabilities, not just those who are deaf.
Seen in a restaurant.
Are you finished with your plate, ma'am?
Oh, yes, thank you.
Do you think he's finished with his?
Well, I don't know. Why don't you ask him?
Remember, when you meet a person with a disability, keep in mind they're a person, not a thing, but a person.
Lightning flashes again on the graphic of Roman numeral 2.
Commandment number 2. Always offer to shake hands when introduced.
Tony Brown, Kung Fu instructor.
When I approach people, I shake their hands. I think that shaking hand is an important part of greeting someone.
In the eastern part of the world, in Asia, it's normal to bow to each other to show respect. And in the West, it's shaking hands. Either way, it's a matter of showing respect.
Face it, people with disabilities sometimes feel left out on social interactions. Certainly when they feel that someone doesn't want to shake their hand, they might feel slighted.
People with limited use of their hand or people with artificial limbs can shake hands too. And offering the left hand is also acceptable. People are people. They when they meet someone, they want to be able to shake their hand. They want to be able to relate to them on a personal level. I'm sure everyone wants to do that. And should be able to express himself.
We viewed people with various disabilities being slighted and appropriately greeted in social situations.
Commandment number 3. Always identify yourself and others who may be with you when meeting someone who is blind.
Department Director Mary Hyland in her office.
In my job, I deal with the same people a lot throughout the week, so I recognize voices. But when there are new people that come into my office, I do need for them to tell me who they are.
Colleague at her door.
Excuse me. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm filling in for the next couple of weeks.
They said you could get those tapes for me.
Now, which...
Hey, Mary's taking care of it.
He'll be back Tuesday. If you could just go ahead and put my name on it.
And you are...
I gotta go.
Colleague leaves.
Gee, I gotta go. Unusual name. now, what... Hello? When people leave the room and don't let you know, it can be really awkward. I know many times I have been left standing talking to the air, and if they would just think a little bit before they do something like that, it would be easier.
Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Yeah, Dave Martin. I'm going to be filling in for Rick and Pat next week.
I understand you can give me those tapes from last week?
Sure, no problem.
Great. Hey, Mary's taking care of it.
That was Rick.
If you could take care of those tapes and put my name on it, that'd be great.
And that's Dave?
Dave Martin. Thanks a lot. Bye now.
Bye, Dave. It's really helpful to let a blind person know what's on the plate and what's on the table.
A waiter brings meals to a woman and a man who's blind.
Thank you. Can I give you a description of what's on your plate, Reggie?
Yeah, I'm starved. What does it look like?
Well, your fries are at the 1 o'clock position. They look really good. And then your dill pickle spear is at the 9 o'clock position. And your hamburger is at the 6 o'clock position with the bun right next to it.
The most helpful thing that you can do when talking with a blind person or dining with a blind person is to allow them to be as independent as they would like to be.
Lightning again introduces graphic of Roman numeral 4.
Commandment number 4. If you offer assistance, wait until the offer is accepted. Then listen, wait, or ask for instruction.
Actress Birdie Larrick.
Everyone has good intentions.
It's just how you use those good intentions that makes all the difference.
Older woman searching for car keys in grocery store parking lot.
Oh, here, I can help you with these. This will be
okay,
no problem.
That'd be
these
good.
Look really heavy. Boy, it's a good thing I came along.
The young man is
really
loading
heavy.
The groceries into a station wagon.
Yeah,
these are really heavy. Do you have your keys yet?
Well, that's what
I can
I'm
help
trying
you back
to
your car
find,
out for
I
you.
Know. Oh, well, thank you, but this is my car.
But her car is a yellow sports car.
People with disabilities, they want to feel as independent as possible. And if that is taken away from them, that's really doing a disservice.
Sonny, does your mommy know you're here?
They're fighting to remain independent. So we shouldn't rob them, really, of that aspect of their lives. So always ask first if they want help, and then how they want it. Walk in their shoes.
We saw a man stopping the wrong direction of traffic at an intersection attempting to assist a person walking with a cane.
Amendment number 5. Treat adults as adults.
Professional Clyde Yoder.
Sometimes people I work with, sometimes they treat me as a juvenile. They treat me as very immature.
I like people who treat me the same way everybody else gets treated. Not special. Just like everybody else.
Sometimes people with disabilities get treated like children. Here's an example.
Hey, Julie, I'm sorry I'm late.
That's okay. I don't think she's going to see me without a big person.
Julie, a person of small stature, has waited for a friend at a restaurant. Waitress now seats them and addresses only Julie's friend, who is of average height.
Would your little friend like a booster seat?
No, her little friend would not like a booster seat. And she would appreciate if you talked to her next time. Okay?
Next, Julie visits her bank.
On the other hand, it's great when someone takes the time to make
Good
things
morning.
Easier
Hello.
To someone with a disability.
How are you today?
Fine.
Good. How can I help you today?
I need to make a deposit and check my balance.
Okay. Why don't you step right over to the desk area and I can help you over there.
We see Julie leave the high counter area and meet the bank teller at a desk to conduct her business.
Thank you. That is much easier.
Address people with disabilities by their first names only when calling everybody else by their first name.
Nurse and patient in exam room.
Dr. Smith?
Yes?
Mr. Wilbur is going to be late today and Mrs. Rogers canceled, so I thought maybe we could see Chris today.
Oh, you mean Mr. Clarkson?
You're right. I mean Mr. Clarkson.
Sure. So, Mr. Clarkson, what seems to be the problem today?
Never patronize people in wheelchairs by patting them on their head or shoulder. I pay bills. I work for a living, and last but certainly not least, I pay my share of my taxes. I'm at the point now where I'm 30, and I deserve to be treated as an adult.
In a previous scene, a woman using a wheelchair is displeased with a man patting her on the shoulder.
Amendment number 6. Do not lean against or hang on someone's wheelchair or cart. Bear in mind that people with disabilities treat their chairs as extensions of their body.
Matt Gray, consultant and trainer.
One thing that really aggravates me is when somebody goes by me and they might bump into my wheel. And because they haven't bumped into my person physically, they don't feel the need to say, excuse me. But that does send a jolt through my body. I've even been to a social function where somebody may put their foot up on my wheel. I said, hey, I'm not a coffee table. I have had people lean up against my chair like I'm some kind of a post, and I'm not. And there's sometimes I really wish I could just show them how inconsiderate they're being.
Mac and his helper dog.
Champ really does do a lot of things for me. He can pick up something as small as a dime or something as important as my TV remote control. Whether it's a helping dog for somebody in a wheelchair or whether it's a guide dog for somebody who's blind, you never want to distract a working animal from its job without the owner's permission. No, I am a person with a disability. I'm not a disabled person. And I want respect just like anybody else. And I would appreciate
respect for my wheelchair and for my dog also.
We saw a comic scene of a man leaning on the wheelchair of another man. The inconsiderate man fell to the floor when the wheelchair moved.
Listen attentively when talking with people who have difficulty speaking. And wait for them to finish.
Consultant and speaker Tim Harrington.
Yeah, I know. I'm supposed to be the host of this. But this commandment hits a little close to home for me. So I'm going to be doing this one. I have cerebral palsy, which affects my speech also. I remember times when I tried to call for pizza when I was in college. And they would hang up on me because they thought I was drunk or trying to pull a prank. And if you like pizza as much as I do, that can be a tragedy. All I can say is be patient. Never pretend to understand. Instead, repeat and paraphrase what you understood and allow the person to respond.
Waitress and customer
I'm
in a
sorry,
restaurant.
You said you wanted a hamburger?
No, I like a cheeseburger.
Oh, a cheeseburger. Let me go ahead and get this straight. Would you like ketchup? Pickles?
Man nods yes to both items.
Lettuce and tomatoes?
Shakes his head no.
Okay.
If necessary, ask questions that require short answers or a nod of the head. Many say that the more they are around people who have speech difficulties, the easier it is for them to understand what they are saying.
Lightning Flash has introduced a graphic of Roman numeral 8.
Commandment number 8. Place yourself at eye level when speaking with someone in a wheelchair or on crutches.
Business owner Al Ballinger.
Many people don't realize how much time a person in a wheelchair spends looking up at other people. I go to a lot of conferences, public events, where it really becomes noticeable. The strain on your neck and your back, it becomes quite uncomfortable and distracting from the conversation. As a co-owner of a van rental service that rents accessible vans for wheelchair users, we come across different people with different disabilities, different behaviors, and when you make an effort to be at eye level with the person, they seem to be more comfortable, more relaxed, and more open with you so that we can get the business at hand conducted. And something else to watch out for is talking to someone in a wheelchair when you're out of their line of sight. It's very difficult to stay in the conversation or focus on it if you're trying to maneuver your chair to catch whoever it is trying to say something to you.
Man in wheelchair turns back and forth repeatedly to follow conversation of co-workers on either side of him.
Commandment number 9. Tap a person who is deaf on the shoulder or wave your hand to get his or her attention.
Shalinda Delaney, administrative assistant.
This is a well-known situation in the deaf community among all my friends.
Hey, I was just in that last presentation with Irene Ward. That was really, really good. How did you enjoy that one?
The man who is deaf, engaged in another conversation, apparently disregards her.
It's important to get the person's attention first.
Hi.
Then look directly at the person, speaking clearly, slowly, and expressively to establish if the person can read lips. If so, try to face the light source and keep hands, cigarettes, and food away from your mouth when speaking. In my own case, since I don't wear a hearing aid or have an interpreter, people may forget that I do have a disability and that I am reading their lips. However, just because a person is using a hearing aid, don't assume they have the ability to discriminate your speaking voice.
Really,
and don't shout at the person. It doesn't help.
How about you, Shalinda? Did you enjoy it?
Just speak in a normal tone of voice.
I can't believe it.
And one more thing.
Shalinda in business.
Well, I wanted to tell you all that the company has just announced the number one data analyst in the state, and it's our own Shalinda Delaney.
It's good to clap in a visual way when you are with deaf people. It shows your appreciation of a deaf culture.
The group applauds, then waves both hands in the air to show recognition, which Shalinda stands to accept.
Commandment number 10. Relax. Don't be embarrassed if you happen to use common expressions that seem to relate to a person's disability.
This last one is so simple. Everyone wanted in on this one. So as I pack up, listen to
Attorney
this.
Heidi Johnson
Wright. When people meet me and they see that I use a wheelchair, sometimes they're a bit uncomfortable about saying certain things. For example, running around, hop, skip, and a jump, walking to the park. But really, I see those things as figures of speech and don't make me uncomfortable, so nobody else really needs to be either.
Most people who haven't been with a blind person are afraid to use the word see or look or watch.
This is Mary Hyland.
But after they've been with me for a while, they realize that I say, see you later. I say, did you see the movie last week? I watch TV. When I talk to even another blind person, I may say, look at this, and hand them something that I want them to see. And there I did it myself.
Marcia Nippert, who is deaf.
Many people say, listen to this, listen to that. That's okay. It's not related to my deafness. It's just a way of people expressing themselves.
We don't say, here, feel this. We say, here, look at this.
I use terms like running, walking, that sort of thing. And when my husband pushes me in my wheelchair, I don't later tell a friend that he walked and I rolled somewhere. So we've really all got better things to worry about than watching every little thing that we say.
People need to lighten up. It's amazing what it does for the atmosphere, not to mention the efficiency of the workplace. If people are always nervous about every word they say, they end up not communicating. And for persons with disabilities, nothing could be worse than that.
All done communicating?
Almost nothing.
That's a mouthful, isn't it? Even for me.
Cut. Can you get her out of here?
1 minute, please. Simple respect. That's what these commandments are all about. Not treating individuals like children, but like adults, who, like everyone else, have different strengths and different needs. You know, we're all different. Some more than others.
Jim opens his office door to leave, revealing the overbearing woman.
There you are. You know, some of my best friends have friends just like you.
Oh, really? So do mine.
Now, I insist on walking you to the bus.
No, thanks. I drove.
All by yourself?
How fast can we get a copy of this video for this woman?
Soon, Mr. Harrington. Real soon.
For me?
Hey, you deserve it.
As Tim walks down the hall, the woman beams with appreciation, but not understanding. Fade up on title, The Ten Commandments of Communicating with People with Disabilities.
So that's the end of our piece, and we do this statewide. We go whenever we're invited. As I work with employers and businesses, you know, oftentimes they would hire somebody with a disability, and then they find that interaction among employees may not be as what it should be for an employee. And so we come in and we do this training with all employees or just the management team and then their employees so that they can get familiar and comfortable in the workplace working with people with disabilities as employees. So it's really useful as an add-on that we do when we're serving or meeting businesses. So anyway, we're glad to be here tonight.
Thank you. Today.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Exactly.
From our committee. Seeing none, we thank you very much, all three, for being here. Appreciate it very much and enjoyed it.
Welcome.
Learned a great deal.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
So watch your DVDs.
Yes. Thank you for reminding us of the DVD.
Yes. Thank you.
numbers and stuff like that. She knows that a good thing.
We have two more items, and with that, I'll turn it over to my co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair, and we'll open up an informational hearing on the abuse of vulnerable victims, an update on House Bill 2442. Representative Gelser, do you want anybody to come up with you right now?
Not yet.
Okay.
Let's do an introduction, and I know there's people.
Thank you for coming today. These ladies' names I can't remember. Thank you. That was very interesting. Did you get all of your eyes?
I think we're gathering them. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. I wanted to come today and have an opportunity to review a part of House Bill 2442 from 2009, which we have not had the opportunity to talk a lot about. If you'll remember, in 2009, House Bill 2442 was a very long bill that did many things in relation to the abuse of vulnerable adults, in particular adults with developmental disabilities. In many ways, it was very similar to the work that we did this past February around elder abuse. We were looking at prevalence and some of the systemic changes we could make in order to keep people safer. We've had lots of conversations in the committee about some other elements of the bill, but one portion of the bill required counties to create multidisciplinary teams for vulnerable adults, and that was to include seniors, people with physical disabilities, people with developmental disabilities, and people with mental illness. And the idea was that counties would tackle these issues with the abuse of adults in much the same way that they tackle the abuse of kids. And again, very similar to the conversations you were having in this committee in February. The reason that we did that was that in 2008, when we began working on what became House Bill 2442, we had a very, very large work group of over 40 people that was talking about this problem of more than one in five adults with developmental disabilities over the course of 7 years experiencing a significant incidence of abuse. We were looking at people who were the abusers continuing to work in these settings, and we were looking at a very low rate of criminal prosecution of this abuse when it occurred. And as we sat in the meetings, there were people who worked at DHS that said, we refer these cases to law enforcement, and then law enforcement never follows up. We never get any prosecutions. The DAs were saying, well, we never get this, or else we would prosecute. And law enforcement said, well, of course, if we were getting these, we would investigate. Maybe they're going to the wrong place. So what we created in House Bill 2442 was a protocol about what would happen when DHS goes out to investigate abuse of a vulnerable adult, and they suspect that abuse rises to the level of a crime. The first thing it requires is that you immediately notify law enforcement. Then it has law enforcement confirm to DHS that they've received that report. Then they have to let DHS know whether or not they're doing a criminal investigation, the results of that investigation, and whether it's forwarded to the DA. Then the DA needs to report back to DHS whether they're going to prosecute the case and why not if they don't. And then if they go to trial, whether or not it results in a conviction. And then these MDTs, at the end of each year, were supposed to send to the Department of Justice and the Criminal Justice Commission a report that summarized for that community the number of substantiated allegations of abuse in the county, the number of those that were forwarded to law enforcement, and then each of those steps after that. So, and just to give you a sense of the type of things we were talking about, this is from some testimony in 2009 about this bill. It says one in five adults with DD in state-paid services experienced significant physical, sexual, or financial abuse since 2000. These included cases of people being controlled with electric dog collars, being grabbed and twisted by the scrotum, being bound with tape, kicked to the floor and threatened with a knife, being thrown against door jams or burned with cigarettes, and being attacked by a moving vehicle.
Representative, I've got to stop you. Could you repeat when this happened, what period of time these abuses happened?
This was between 2000 and 2009.
Thank you.
Between the time we heard this bill. These are crimes, but they were not prosecuted. These were some of the cases that never moved forward to prosecution. So that was the impetus behind the legislation. We continue, of course, to have problems with abuse in the community, and one of the concerns that we've tried to address is how to improve the safety of the workforce, and we've had many debates about how to use criminal background checks and whether or not these types of abuses in the system ever become recorded as prosecuted or convicted crimes, how you can do that if they aren't being prosecuted. So we passed this legislation, and we also put a sunset on it. We had hoped that if we put it together and we had the opportunity for people to practice these forms of communication, one, we would get the data that we needed. Why weren't these cases being prosecuted? Was it a lack of resources? Was it because there weren't very many of these that rose to the level of a crime? Was there something different that we needed to do with investigations? But we also thought that besides getting that data after the period of time, that communities would have had the opportunity to develop their best possible methods of communication, and it didn't make sense to have a statute that said, you shall do this in 2 days, and you shall do this in 5 days forevermore, that we would do that for a short period of time. So since the bill was implemented on July 1st of 2009, despite everyone's best intentions, and I do believe that everyone has very good intentions, there are no bad guys in this, just a lot of people that are working very hard with grossly inadequate resources. I think that some of the challenges with implementation that you'll hear about today are the adoption of the protocol. There are some counties that still today have not yet, to my understanding, developed and put into writing for their county this communication protocol. There certainly are not adequate resources to support multidisciplinary teams, and whether that's a multidisciplinary team for a vulnerable adult, a multidisciplinary team for children. And I think that if you don't hear more today, you may hear elsewhere we grossly underfund victim services in the state of Oregon. And just this past February, we turned back about $56.2 million that otherwise would have gone to victim services and things like county multidisciplinary teams for victims, but we used that money to plug the state budget hole rather than sending that to victims as we had previously outlined in statute. The other problem that you may hear about is that we do have a bifurcation of our systems for abuse investigation for vulnerable adults. We have one system that investigates abuse for seniors and people with physical disabilities, and we have another system that primarily investigates abuse for individuals experiencing mental illness and those that experience developmental disabilities. And so if you remember last February when we were working on elder abuse, the Oregonian released an article about the rate of abuse in the state of Oregon, and it talked about elders and people with disabilities. That data did not include the information about people with developmental disabilities and mental health, because that is reported in a separate report. One of the very exciting things that the Office of Investigation and Trainings is doing with that report around developmental disabilities and mental health now is that in addition to the numbers, they're tiering it. So you can see, you know, this many could have put somebody at harm, or there was no financial loss, all the way to there was ongoing significant harm and a significant financial loss. So that will help us better identify how many of these cases were probably criminal in nature, and it will give us a better sense of what type of abuse we're seeing in the system. Communication has been difficult. I think it's especially difficult in larger counties where you might have a district attorney's office with many, many, many divisions, and different cases might fall into different divisions. That can make these protocols more challenging to kind of communicate and know where the information is coming from. And I think probably the biggest barrier to implementation is that we experimented with not having a final report. We asked the counties to send this information to the Criminal Justice Commission and to the Department of Justice, but we decided not to ask the Criminal Justice Commission and the Department of Justice to submit a summary report to the legislature because we didn't want to burden them with a report. And I think we all know we have a lot of mandated reports, and sometimes we wonder, why do we do that? I think what I learned from the system is we do that because if we're asking someone to get the data, there has to be some accountability to gather it so that we can use the data that we are trying to get. A couple of requests that I would have of the committee that I hope that you might consider going into the next legislative session is that we consider extending the sunset on this part of the bill so that we give it the opportunity to work, given that the protocols haven't been implemented in all counties yet, that perhaps you consider adding a brief follow-up hearing in December so that we can get the rest of the 2011 numbers, and you'll hear about that a little later. There's a misalignment of when data is available to put together into these reports, that in 2013 we add that final report in there, and we ask either the Criminal Justice Commission or the Department of Justice to provide that compiled information about abuse of all vulnerable adults, including those with developmental disabilities, elders, physical disabilities, and mental health, to the legislature. That we work towards aligned systems for vulnerable adults so that as we move forward in the next step of elder abuse and developmental disability abuse, perhaps we combine those efforts so that we don't exacerbate that problem of bifurcated systems, for instance, by having one 800 number to call for elder abuse and telling people, well, you might be a 60-year-old person with Down syndrome. You're not an elder, so we're going to have you call a different number. We should create a system that has one entry point. The same with trainings and information and work groups, bringing everyone together, recognizing the unique needs of the populations, but trying to get away from this completely bifurcated system. We also probably need to look at better cross-agency reporting of internal findings within the DHS abuse reporting system. I know I met with a constituent the other week who talked about a family member that had just come through a child abuse allegation, a restraining order, threatening to cut somebody into pieces, and then went directly back to work as a direct care provider in a residential facility for adults with developmental disabilities. If our systems could talk with each other internally, again, we could improve the safety of our most vulnerable people. And the last recommendation is to really look at the importance of funding victim services and recognizing that when we do that, that's not just a follow-up, it's actually preventive. If we can have this data, if we can understand how we can intervene earlier, we will have fewer victims. And that means protecting victim service dollars and providing the resources that counties, district attorneys, Department of Justice and the CJC need to support these types of victim services programs that we have across the state. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them or move on to the great people that are doing this work.
Okay, I think we're ready to move on. Thank you. Will you be joining us, or do you
want to? I'd love to.
Okay, thank you. So we have several people listed, and I understand there's somebody else who has come. Is there some, should some people come up in groups, do you think?
Yeah, I think you could call everybody.
Okay. Patrice Botsford, Bob Jundiff, Elizabeth Kushwan. Elizabeth, I think you're bringing John.
Turn off Siri, will you please?
I did turn violently. So hi.
Hi.
And Bob and Marie Cervantes. And then Craig Prince, you'll be coming up later. Okay, great. Thank you so much. Would you like some water?
No, I have terrible allergies, and I apologize. Oh. There's not much that actually helps it.
So I know. Representative,
I get this lovely voice as a result as well. So my apologies in advance.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. I'm Patrice Botsford. I'm the Division Director for Multnomah County Developmental Disabilities, so co-chairs and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to update you on where we are in the implementation of the multiple disciplinary teams provided for in 2009's House Bill 2442. The multiple disciplinary team process includes Multnomah County Developmental Disability and Mental Health staff and the Multnomah County Public Guardians Representative, as well as participation by the District Attorney's Office, Portland Police Bureau's Sergeant Bonson, Gresham Police, Fairview and Troutdale Police, and Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. Smaller jurisdictions attend if there's a specific case to review.
The Multnomah County DD Human Services investigation staff have very positive things to say about both the participants and the process. The multiple disciplinary team has provided them an opportunity to staff very complicated cases, providing professional insight and support as those cases move toward prosecution or push back to our human services investigators to complete. Our investigators had developed an understanding of the limitations of each of the programs and agencies at the table, and it has provided the opportunity to train participating agencies on what DD can and cannot do per the Oregon Administrative Rule in these very difficult cases. The DD Mental Health MDT has also provided a networking tool that furthers prosecution where appropriate, but perhaps more importantly, has provided a group of skilled problem solvers for all of the agencies. I would like to share a statement made by Sandra Potter, a seasoned investigator who has served in that capacity in Multnomah County for 22 years. She states, "I find the multiple disciplinary team very beneficial. It's a great opportunity to review a case with the agencies involved in the investigation and prosecution of criminal acts. It's been helpful in getting cases assigned through law enforcement agencies and helpful in knowing what information the DA would need before they would be able to move forward with prosecution. It's also helpful because we develop connections with other agencies in these meetings, which helps us to move forward quickly with other cases. The individuals who have been representing the DA's office and the law enforcement agencies have also been very helpful in these meetings by providing many trainings on issues that affect us in working together on prosecuting cases," close quote. There were five other similar statements from our staff. "The multiple disciplinary teams has provided a key tool not only to educate, check in, and train, but to keep cases moving forward in the prosecution process. Even with the significant challenges due to funding reductions in both social service agencies and law enforcement, the prosecutions and convictions show over a 100% increase in 2011 over 2010. This is an improvement that bears noting. However, there's still a great deal of work to do. We want to thank co-chairs Gilliam and Tomai and the representative Gelser, pardon me, for the passion they bring to the table on this topic. We value the relationships that have been fostered with the partners in the MDT, and we are invested in continuing those for the benefit and positive outcome of the people with developmental disabilities whom we serve and who have a right to a safe and secure community." Thank you.
Questions of Ms. Bosworth?
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, I'm Marie Cervantes. I'm the director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations, and I'll explain that name in a little bit because it will relate to some of the recommendations that Representative Gelser made to you in her presentation. I'm going to provide an update around the agency structure and a little bit of the alignment work that we've done with adult protection, and then an update on House Bill 2442 and activities and efforts that we have taken by our agency to support that work, and then provide a statewide update of data that we have gathered around the efforts around multidisciplinary teams. So as you all heard, there's a new name there, Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations. And there's a reason for that. The purpose is to focus on abuse prevention, and the new name encompasses all the prior offices that served adult protection in the past. So what we did was went through all the core functions, all the mission critical work of our various programs, and one of the recommendations and a culmination of many months of work was to have all of adult protection under one roof. So we now have this new office. It encompasses the Office of Investigations and Training. It encompasses Facility Adult Protective Services, which are the folks that are responsible for investigations in licensed care settings. And it also encompasses the investigations that are done in community settings, which are individuals that live in their own homes. So we're really new into this venture, which has been led by our director, Aaron Kelly Seal, with a focus on improved customer service and better client outcomes. So more to come. You will hear a more formal announcement probably in the next couple of weeks. We're about 3 months into this journey, but really wanting to focus more on being very visible to the public, accessibility,
some of the recommendations that we're looking at from the Adult Safety and Protection Team, which Co-Chair Gilliam was a part of, is around centralized screening and one number for abuse. So it really is focusing on one way to access our services to vulnerable adults. The next piece that I want to touch on is who is served by our office so that we have an understanding of who vulnerable adults are. So those are individuals over the age of 65. It can be an individual with a physical or a cognitive disability, or a person over the age of 18 with a developmental disability who's receiving services from a community program or previously determined eligible to be receiving services, or an individual over the age of 18 with a mental illness who's receiving services from a community program or a facility. So it really brings together everybody into one program. We're leveraging our resources, our expertise, all together. I want to give you some updates on what our agency has done to support the efforts of House Bill 2442, and part of that started with my predecessor, Eva Kutos, with the Office of Investigations and Training, and upon passage of House Bill 2442, she worked to craft language for interagency agreements, which assist the district attorneys in setting up MDTs. So part of this encompassed looking at Oregon models that were in place. It encompassed looking at national models that were in place, working with the Attorney General's office in regard to language, and a sample was crafted and shared with a couple counties, Multnomah being one of those and Clackamas County being the other. So there was a lot of work done there. There's also training tours in several cities, including Coos Bay, Pendleton, and Klamath Falls. And one training director met with local service providers and local office staff to assist with identifying issues and needs in order to bring MDTs serving individuals with developmental disabilities into operation. DHS initially implemented House Bill 2442 obligations for MDT development by mandating and ruling that our offices, both APS and the county DD programs, participate with MDT development. So it is encompassed in our Oregon administrative rules. We have also been tracking MDTs by county, and our data reflects that there are MDTs in, and again, this is data that isn't fully vetted, but it's the best that we could gather at the time to tell us that there are some improvements that we're seeing in multidisciplinary teams. We have information from our local offices that there's MDTs in 31 of the 36 counties, that 21 of those 31 MDTs include individuals from the mental health or developmental disabilities programs as participants. And the majority of MDTs, as reported by our local office, they staff cases, provide education and training, and they discuss prosecution of cases and strategies around prevention of abuse. One example of a model MDT is Clackamas County that's led by Senior Deputy District Attorney John Wentworth. The protocols for this county include a mission and a purpose statement, composition of the MDT, responsibilities, vulnerable adult abuse protocols as identified by House Bill 2442, and standards for the records and the minutes. Other efforts coordinated by our office include providing official direction to our field offices to support and engage with district attorneys in the MDT efforts. This included a statewide query to see where development outreach was needed so that we could target these efforts and help out the DA Association. We also engaged in some outreach in January of 2012 with the DA Association to see what else we could do to help. Fred Steele, who is our Community Adult Protective Services Community Adult Protective Services Manager, has also been working with John Wentworth to talk with DAs and see how they can help move these efforts forward. With the passage of House Bill 4084 in February and the subsequent action of the Elder Abuse Work Group, we anticipate that additional collaboration will be fostered between law enforcement, MDTs, and Adult Protective Services. So lastly, in an effort to make improvements to Oregon's APS system, the Adult Safety and Protection Team, which was led by our DHS director, and there were legislators, long-term care ombudsman, around 20 different entities or individuals or stakeholders involved in adult protection or in the rights of individuals with disabilities. They met from April to July of 2011. And as a result of those efforts, they made recommendations. And there were top, there were top 10 recommendations, one of those being for law enforcement, district attorneys, and APS to work together. So that supports House Bill 2442 and those efforts as well. I'm happy to take any questions that you might have. If you have any questions about the department, again, we've done a lot of design work, and I've asked Mary Lee Fay to be here from Developmental Disabilities to answer any questions that I might not know, being 3 months into my new job.
Glad to have you here. Thank you so much. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question. I'll probably go as you're setting this up, and with you being new to it, I don't know if you're here when all of this was going through last session, but I know Representative Greenlick kind of had an issue with this, myself and a few other members, but it's the definition of a vulnerable adult, because you get in the classification right now where people are living longer, their minds are still, and they're in a great state of mind and everything, but they would fall into it because of an age classification. I'm just wondering, that might be something we want to look at as we go forward with this process, because just putting age 65 on there, because that's what we define in statute for retirement and different things like that, doesn't necessarily mean you're a vulnerable adult. So I don't know if you have had those discussions, but it may be something you may want to look at as we go forward. So you can respond, or you can just keep it in the back of your mind that it's something we need to address.
Yes, thank you, Representative Widener, members of the committee. I do remember that conversation, and I have worked in Adult Protective Services for about 18 years. So in regard to being the age of 65 and being a member of a protected population, what part of that consideration is a person's ability to protect themselves. So when a call comes in, you know, there's a couple criteria. One of those is being over the age of 65, but the other piece of that is that an allegation of abuse has been made, and then we're weighing the person's ability to protect themselves. If we were to go to somebody's home and they said, hey, Marie, I know what's happening here. I understand. I know the risks. Go away. We go away. So we balance that with a right to a person's self-determination. So there's balance there. So I don't know if that clarifies, but I hear your point, and I heard it in previous hearings. So,
well, and it really becomes the issue on the financial stuff for going into their personal records without their knowledge. So, and that was the big concern. So, but we fixed a lot of that in the bill, but I'm just wondering if there's something we can do with the classification there. But it sounds like you kind of do that through questioning a little bit with contact with the individual. So.
Representative Gelser, did you have something to add here?
I did. I had a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's exciting to hear about the changes and the collaboration within the agency. I'm wondering if in your communications with the multidisciplinary teams and the DAs, when there is a combined MDT that has elder abuse and developmental disability populations, are you finding any challenge in terms of elevating and recognizing the vulnerability of adults with developmental disabilities? And the reason that I ask about that is almost everyone is aware of elder abuse. And I noticed as protocols were forwarded to me, they often have the subject line elder abuse without recognizing maybe the 30-year-old or the 50-year-old with the intellectual disability. The second reason that I'm concerned about it is that, you know, we have a historical situation in Oregon where we have a whole population of 40, 50, 60-year-old people who came out of Fairview. And because they came out of Fairview, they were cut off from all of their natural ties. So while the elderly have children and grandchildren and others who are advocating for them, many of these other vulnerable adults that we're talking about really don't have that built-in natural support around them because our state policy cut them off from those natural supports when they were children and they went into the institution. So can you talk a little bit about what is being done to ensure in this collaboration that developmental disabilities isn't lost to elder abuse and that we're looking at both of them?
Okay. Thank you, Representative Gelser, members of the committee. I can appreciate those comments. I don't believe our work's done here. I think we're working with our field offices to ask them to continue to raise those issues and make sure that we're inclusive of everybody that has a disability in terms of our MDTs. Part of the redesign of our office was to leverage our attention as well as our resource on all people with disabilities. So I think those are some steps forward that will help. We're also engaging with our National Adult Protective Services associations to, you know, on our national conferences to make sure that we're including people with disabilities of different types of disabilities, because that has been not as prevalent. So the short answer is there's work to be done. Are we committed to doing it? Yes, we are.
Thank you.
Yes.
Any further questions? Thank you so much. Bob.
Thank you, Co-Chair Tomei and Representative Gilliam. My name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. One of the tasks of our organization as the federally funded protection advocacy system is to investigate complaints of abuse and neglect of people with disabilities in Oregon, and we work very closely with state offices in order to fulfill that task. And I'm speaking to you today just to give our own perspective on where we are right now. And my overall impression is that we are making progress, but we need to continue to make progress. And one of the things that I've done is just to provide you with some data about criminal victimization of people with disabilities. As you know, data is hard to find these days sometimes, but this is an area in which we have good local and national data on the crime statistics for people with disabilities. And I'm not going to go through them all, they're right here, but as you can see that victimization of people with disabilities in the federal crime statistics is about twice that of people who are able-bodied. And for sex crimes, it's significantly higher. We're in a situation in which we have individuals who are more vulnerable to certain types of crimes, and this obviously is a significant problem that involves more than social service agencies. It must reach out to the criminal justice system. And to the extent that we are just starting to move into better coordination with the criminal justice system, this is something we really need to continue if we're going to put a dent in these statistics. And that's why I think that the steps that we've taken so far are positive and important, but more needs to be done. And so if there is a question of a sunset on this bill, I think it would be very important to continue it so that this committee and legislators can be assured that the wide variety of steps that have been conceived as a way to address this particular problem have a chance to be shown that they can work. And if they can, great. If not, let's keep working on it. Abuse is not going to go away, but it's something that we really can effectively address. The last thing I wanted to say, just as a matter of importance of this area to other areas of disability policy, is that, as you know, we continue to work to enhance people's lives so that they can contribute more to society through work and through more active lives in our communities. But as people step out, there's risks. Part of addressing those risks is to make sure that we have an effectively working abuse reporting investigation system that brings people to who may violate laws or may be abusers, holds them accountable for their actions. And so having that piece of the puzzle is important to our overall policy goals of enhancing lives for people with disabilities and their families in our communities. And so I'd urge you to keep on keeping on in this area.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, go ahead.
Sure.
I'm waiting.
Real quick here. I'm just looking at the cases reported on page one, and it goes to page two, and it just talks about some national stuff. Are these nationally reported numbers or state numbers?
co-chairs, Representative Widener, the items listed at the bottom of page one are from the Office of Information Investigation and Training, which is now has a new name, which I have to learn, from their report for 2010. So those are Oregon. That's Oregon.
State of Oregon.
Oregon data.
Yeah, Oregon data. And there's a much greater wealth of information. I just took out some particularly salient numbers.
Well, they would have been awfully low if it was nationwide. Right. I would sit here and scratch, right. But that's what I wanted to know.
Thank you, Representative Griffin Greenlick.
Bob, I was intrigued with the relatively high proportion in the DD population of validated cases among those that are reported, which leads me, as opposed to the children's, where there's a relatively smaller proportion, it seems to me that there's a probably much higher threshold for reporting, and you make that point later that a lot of the DD abuse cases are not reported, but it looks like you've succeeded in getting people to report suspicions of children's abuse in a way that's very different than we've been able to succeed in getting that same kind of trigger to report possible abuse. I mean, if such a high proportion is validated, it means probably only the most egregious cases are being reported.
Co-chair's
observation.
Greenlick, I think that's a correct observation. I, as a lawyer, have to undergo. I'm mandated to receive 1 hour of training in child abuse reporting every 3 years. I have no such requirement for elder abuse or disability abuse. There's a different weights given, and most certainly most people that I interact with are unaware of the mandatory nature of the reporting of abuse of people with developmental disabilities and mental illness. This is information that's known within the service systems, but not out within the general public, even though there's an obligation for a variety of law enforcement professionals under the statutes to report that abuse. Again, as we have more people being more active in the general population, I'd hope that knowledge gets out there so that that people know how to respond to when they see a problem. And as Representative Gelzer was pointing out, we've been talking about having a statewide call number, at least for elder abuse. And since if we develop one, it would be great if it were for all mandatory abuse reporting.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm glad you asked that question.
Thank you.
I'm probably spending too much time looking at these charts, but just real quick on page two, it's the crimes against persons with disability, and it's your 2008 to 2010. And you're looking at persons with disabilities, and in 2008 and 2009, just for simple assault, you're 482,630. Then in 2000, and that's for 2009, 2010 goes to 284,000, almost cut in half. Well, is there any reason for that decline?
Co-chairs, Representative Widener, I can't explain the data. It comes from our federal agencies, but I would be happy to look into it and get back to you on it.
Persons without disabilities, it kind of stays the same across the board, but I just noticed that with disabilities, that dramatic drop there, because 8 and 9 are both up 458,000, 482,000, then it goes to 284, so just kind of curious what changed or what was the difference there. It'd be nice to know that, because definitely something was done right for something to be cut almost in half.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you look, and again, I can't explain how they put these numbers down, but if you look at the serious violent crime numbers, they're actually up. And so going from 2009 to 207,000 and the 282,000. So I don't know if the math works, but...
Right, and I was looking down at simple assault and some of the other ones, so I'd just kind of be curious to take a look at how they compile these numbers or come up with them, so...
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a pretty drastic drop overall, so...
Any further questions? Okay, thank you so much. So I believe next we have, Elizabeth, are you coming up? Okay, Elizabeth, Craig Prinz, and John Wentworth.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I'm having deja vu. Look on both sides of our desk.
We're getting our old committee back.
Yeah, exactly. Even though one of them is kind of asleep at the wheel over there.
She's real cozy. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm the executive director of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And the first thing I'd like to do is to say how nice it is to see you all again and to thank you so much for your work on the elder abuse bill this last session. I think it's going to make a huge difference in the lives of so many Oregonians. It put elder abuse on par with child abuse, Representative Greenlick, and we're hoping that with that new piece, we can start to develop the 20 years worth of data that child abuse has as a head on elder abuse. I'd like to, what you're being distributed now is a chart as well as the gold standard of protocols developed by John Wentworth to my right from Clackamas County. The data you see in front of you is from 2011. I'd like to say a couple of things about it. The first thing is there are only six counties without protocols now. And Representative Gelser referenced the idea of having systems to be able to talk internally about these kinds of things. And the one thing that we do know in our systems, at least in district attorney systems in the 36 counties, is there's no such thing as standardized systems, even in the 36 county DA's office. So that could be also a potential problem for housing data. I think the idea of housing it at the Criminal Justice Commission seems like a fine idea to me. Also going to Representative Gelser's comments about the idea of so many of those reports that she received being billed elder abuse or adult abuse. Many MDTs were actually in existence prior to House Bill 2442, and they were incorporated into those MDTs. So that is one reason for that. Again, we have so many more now, thanks to this bill, than we had before, but we are making progress. OIT, the Office of Investigations and Trainings, provides to the counties annually these reports, usually in June or July. So we're a little bit early on the 2011 data for you. What happens is that data was actually just given to me on Friday, and distributed out to the counties for their MDTs, and they usually meet once a month. So you have some framework of time about this. One bright spot, I think, in DD, despite the resource issues, is in Lincoln County, which just last week started their first DD court, a court designed to deal with developmentally disabled Oregonians. And this is a very much an experimental test case being done on grant money in Lincoln County. We'll keep you posted on how that's going. But just also, just quickly to touch on the resource issue, which I know that Representative Gelser talked about, and this is by no means an excuse for why this data hasn't been more complete that's been given to you. But if you look at this revised statute, you get 531 pages of district attorney mandates, including four MDTs. Those MDTs have been unfunded. Josephine County is about to go, has just lost four deputy district attorneys, going down to a district attorney and one deputy. Lane County is losing seven deputy district attorneys, as well as 12 support staff. Columbia County has been asked to take a 25% reduction in the DA's office. Curry County was asked to submit budgets of 35 and 65% reductions. And so while the district attorneys are doing their best to comply by pulling this information together for you, understand that we're going to be continuing to struggle with prioritizing when we're not prosecuting B felonies in some counties, when some counties are no longer prosecuting misdemeanors. I am not in any way trying to minimize the important work that's being done in this bill or for this population. I just ask you to understand why perhaps this data is not as complete as you would prefer. I'd be happy to answer any questions or give you to John Wentworth, who'd be happy to answer.
Questions? All right. Thank you so much.
Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam and members of the community or committee, thank you for having me back once again. I'm here, I think, in part, I hope, as an example of the good work that is being done, has been done in our county that we're sharing with other counties throughout the state. If you remember, 6 to 8 months ago, you indulged me while I explained some of the process.
Identify yourself.
I'm sorry. Thank you. John Wentworth with the Clackamas County District Attorney's Office.
Thank you, John.
I appreciate that. Indulge me while I talked about some of the challenges that we faced as we were putting our committee together, as we were developing our protocol. And I have to tell you, it was a Herculean effort, not just in putting the protocol together, or I'm sorry, putting the committee together. The multidisciplinary team, the players were there and were eager to participate and were eager to have us kind of, meaning the district attorney's office, share with them what we could do for them and what they could do for us. And so there was eagerness in terms of the communication, but I have to tell you that developing the protocol was a lot of work. The House Bill 2442 was a tremendous asset to being able to put that together, but we had to fill in some gaps as well. And my concern was that statewide, the work that we were able to do in our county might have been daunting, perceived as being daunting to counties such as Coos and Curry and Douglas and other counties that don't have the resources like Clackamas County does to dedicate a person, me, to handling cases involving vulnerable adults. That's a luxury. That's a luxury that other offices don't have throughout the state. I spent 4.5 years down in Coos County as a prosecutor, and I can tell you we had little time to do much else than just prosecute. So, you know, we're fortunate in the Portland area, and we recognize that. And the other thing I want to share is that I'm proud of the effort that's been done so far, and that's recognizing that there's a ways to go. I say that because 10 years ago, to my knowledge, there was one office in the whole state. That was Multnomah County, that actually had someone dedicated to handling cases involving vulnerable adults. Now Clackamas County has a prosecutor that does that. Multnomah County has two. Washington County has one. And there are prosecutors throughout the state that are getting up to speed in this area. And that's because there's a recognition that this is a critical area of investigation and prosecution that's been neglected for so long. But we're ready to do it. And so there's enthusiasm throughout the state, at least among the DA's offices, and I know among the social service agencies, to make this a priority. And so I'm proud of the effort that's been done, and that's not to say that it's done at all. There's still a lot further to go. One of the things that I want to share with you that I don't know if it's a concern, but I want to raise it as a concern in terms of the data that you have in front of you. One of the things that we learned as we put our MBT together and went through this process was to realize that what is defined as abuse among the social service agencies is different than what I would call abuse as a criminal prosecutor. And that's not to say that I don't look at things and think, I wish that person hadn't been injured. But sometimes there are people who are injured in, say, a care facility because of an accident, because someone, you know, they made a mistake, or someone got hurt and no one was really to blame. That wouldn't be a case that would come to my office as a prosecutable case, because there's no one to prosecute. It's just something that happens. For a social service agency, that's defined as abuse. And so you'll see in the charts that their numbers are higher than what we see in the DA's office, significantly so. That being said, I appreciated one of the prior speakers mentioned that the numbers appear to be low, but that we've doubled, I think the county was Multnomah County, they've doubled the number of prosecutions that they had in the previous year. We have seen the same thing in Clackamas County. Part of that is because we are sharing with the social service agencies what we call abuse. There was some lack of communication there in terms of what they recognized as being a potential crime. They just deal in the world of people getting hurt, and sometimes there's someone to blame and sometimes there isn't. But what makes that a crime? And where can we communicate with one another to make sure that the people who are being harmed by others are actually prosecuted? And we're in the process of sharing some of that information. I'm going to be doing some trainings with DHS, and we have some trainings coming up in Clackamas County that we're going to share among other counties. So we're excited about that, and that is all part of the efforts that have come out of the legislature in terms of House Bill 2442 and the more recent House Bill 4084 that you just worked on. So I'm enthusiastic. I'm optimistic about where we're going and how far we've come. Recognize that there's more work to do. But if you have any questions about anything that's before you, I'd be happy to answer those.
Any questions today?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Brenda.
Thank you. And I just wanted to make a comment. I appreciate all of the work that's been done. And as mentioned in the opening comments, appreciate the resource challenge. But I think it's also important, while it's progress, that we have so many counties that now have these multidisciplinary teams. It's actually been mandated in statute for over 3 years that every county have one. So I think it's always important to remember that statute is not aspirational. It's statute. Again, recognizing that there's challenges, but I hope that people recognize it's not just a good thing to do, it's required by law to do it, and the outcome is keeping people safer, as we see 100% increase in successful prosecutions is a pretty big deal when you're talking about a very vulnerable population of people.
Representative Gelzer, I absolutely agree with you. I recently met with the elected DA officials, Fred Steele and I did, to discuss that very issue. There is no lack of enthusiasm, I can assure you. But there is, we're trying to break down those barriers of, you know, things like, we don't have a protocol, what do we do? Or, you know, I shared our protocol recently with a small county in Eastern Oregon, or we don't have the people to dedicate to that. We're sharing information among ourselves so that we can get this going. And that's what I want you to get a sense. You're absolutely right. It's taken too long, but it's working. It's picking up speed. Okay. Because I'm completely happening.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, John. Thank you for coming, Craig.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, I'm Craig Prinz from the Criminal Justice Commission. I think this is an example of the systems trying to adapt and learn as we move forward. If you look broadly, violent crime has dropped in Oregon, but I think that just shows that these vulnerable populations that we have not done a good job with, we're trying to adapt and learn how to do better with these. And I think Representative Gelzer and the work of this, you know, this body and this committee on these bills, our role at the CJC, and Ms. Savelle is here in the back from the Department of Justice. Our role in this is really to work with folks like Mr. Wentworth and make sure that statewide people know how to comply with the statute, how to improve working to have successful prosecutions. And I couldn't agree more with Representative Gelzer regarding reinvesting in victim services. I think when you look at the governor's 10-year plan, I think it's so important that we look at investment in that area as we, you know, as we try to, really adapt for the next 10 years. And so I just, I think Section 9 of the bill in 2442 was the area that I think the directive was for the DAs to give the reports to Department of Justice and the Criminal Justice Commission. Ms. Kushwa has been working real hard with the DAs to get that data to us, and we can, collate it together so you can have a statewide look. In meeting with Representative Gelzer, I think one of the things she mentioned in trying to be kind to us, if we don't have a due date of a report by which DOJ and the Criminal Justice Commission will report to you all, we just frankly did not, take hold of this the way we would have if there was something like that. So thank you for trying to, make it easy on us. And I now see, I think, our role in this. Honestly, at first, I didn't understand, that there is a role for us. And so I know that that was one of the things we talked about, that there was not a due date. I don't think there was a reporting date also in the bill as it came out in 09 for the DAs to give the reports to us. So that would be helpful, and then we can look at how, working with the Department of Justice, look at how to, you know, make sure that the whole state, and I think, you know, identifying the counties that have fewer resources than Clackamas can work on this issue together. So thank you for that time.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Prim?
I guess I just want to emphasize again, Representative Gelser, the point you were making. This is not permissive. 2442 was not permissive. It was required. It was by law. So I hope that message goes out to the DAs. This is not something that the legislature is suggesting happen. We are saying this will happen. This must happen by law.
Representative Chair,
someone wants some money to help it out. Mm-hmm.
I know that. I know that. That's another different story. But I guess the message is a strong message that we're hoping to send. We're hoping that had been sent. This is not permissive. This is required by law.
And Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I think that I was not representing the district attorneys in 10 when the first report was to have been done. The 11 numbers are just coming in now. We're giving you the information as we have them. We understand clearly that this is a legislative mandate upon us. We understand the statutory nature of this very clearly. We also understand that there are many other statutes, including felonies and misdemeanors, that have mandated that we aren't able to do now at this time either. And when we're talking about protecting populations, we're talking about protecting all of the population.
And I think the message we're hoping comes from this committee and from the law is that vulnerable populations are extremely important to us. Sometimes they're the ones that are easier to ignore. And I think the intent of that bill and this committee is that those populations will not be ignored. They must be addressed. So I understand their drawbacks, but we feel very strongly that this must be addressed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Shannon Seville, do you want to come up and is there anything you'd like to say to the committee about this issue?
Madam Co-Chair, I don't have anything to add, but I'm happy to approach your questions.
Anybody want to hear from her? All right. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you all for being here. With that, I will close the...
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could I just say thank you so much for taking the time to do this, and I wanted to thank the district attorneys and the Criminal Justice Commission and the Department of Justice and DHS who have been very responsive over the past couple of months to try to figure out how to make this work, and I'm deeply grateful for the work you're doing and the burdens you face and look forward to seeing it all get even better.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Thanks for your input. With that, we'll close the informational hearing on abuse of vulnerable victims, update on House Bill 2442. And we will open up an informational hearing on the Early Learning Council. And thank you, Mr. Shepherd, for coming today. And welcome, Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
It's sort of like
old home week. Talking kids. Happy to be here.
Good.
Co-Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Duke Shepherd from the governor's office. And I spent a lot of time with you in the February session working on House Bill 4165, which did pass 51-9 in the House and 26-4 in the Senate. And I'm here to give you an update on the work to date on the deliverables in that legislation. So I've passed out a variety of things to give you a sense of where we're going and the progress we've made on the deliverables. One of the keys that you can keep, I'll get you adjustments as we adjust them, but I hope we don't change this too much, is our timeline for the key deliverables for the legislature. The Early Learning Council, the 9 members currently, will be expanded in time for July 1, which is when the State Commission on Children and Families goes away, and that council will take up those duties related to early learning and the duties that are required of it under the Head Start Act. It will become the Head Start Advisory Council, which was a component of the legislation as of July 1. So the governor is currently reviewing candidates for those appointments. Likewise, on the governance side, the governor's going to be appointing the Youth Development Council that will be created, that was created in that legislation again to start July 1, and we're doing outreach and vetting of potential candidates for that body. The key pieces that are the furthest along or that I can report the greatest progress on. The kindergarten readiness assessment. There was a requirement in the legislation to implement a kindergarten readiness assessment so that we can determine when children arrive in kindergarten, how ready they are for school, and then you all as the legislature and local communities can determine how to best improve or adjust early learning systems and then to improve those results for kids. And then the K-12 system can use those results to help teachers make determinations about how to best serve those children. So the legislation directed that a pilot be conducted in this fall, 2012, for statewide rollout in 2013. And we convened a team. I've handed out the roster of really more experts to figure out how to what goes into a kindergarten readiness assessment and how to make that happen. We've conducted an online survey of superintendents to gauge what they currently do and their interest in the assessment. We've had focus groups of parents, kindergarten teachers, superintendents, and administrators, and early childhood educators around the state. We will have community workshops starting next week in Portland, Pendleton, Redmond, Salem, and Roseburg, and then we will also, we're working to schedule one on the coast. We have researchers engaged from the University of Oregon and Oregon State University to help us sort through the assessment to determine the options. We've narrowed them down from 49 to 14 and to further narrow those down to get us the best one for Oregon. Districts will have to volunteer for the pilot. This is not meant to be an imposition upon them. It is meant to be a tool for all of us to improve what we do. So we've had a lot of contacts from districts that are interested, but and we've sent out a letter from the governor and the chair of the Early Learning Council to districts just last week asking for those pilot sites that will be selected in order to somewhat randomly, but to ensure that statewide all the demographics we want to reach are covered, in geography, race, ethnicity, income. While we can't do all districts because there is a cost to this, we certainly want to make sure that what we get is valid because this pilot, if it's going to roll out in 2013, we're going to need to take a look back, do a validation study, and move pretty quickly.
How many pilot sites will there be, Duke?
So we've been talking about 12 to 15.
12 to 15, and starting this fall?
Yes.
Coming fall.
The second component that has the most progress at this time is the tiered quality rating and improvement system for early childhood settings and childcare settings. You may recall this is moving toward the best example I still use for people, which is not great, but it works, is similar to a four-star system for hotels, that if we find if we do this correctly, we can have a system that gives incentives for improving quality. So if you're a licensed setting, and this would be just for a licensed setting, which are settings that serve more than three kids, to be a four-star program that would be based on things like the quality of your workforce and the kinds of instruction that you use, down to just the basic number one star entry would be licensure. You're licensed, you're good enough to care for kids on a regular basis. And so we've had input dates around the state, 9 of those so far, with 2 more scheduled and 4 more being scheduled, that we think by the fall the Child Care Division can begin to roll out this statewide and engage providers in participating in it, and then we can, over the next year, determine how to tweak it and improve it over time. We did receive, the state Child Care Division received a grant from the BUILD Initiative, which is a multi-state, multi-foundation effort supporting young children and these kinds of efforts to ensure the cultural competency of the TQRS. So what we're doing is noticed nationally, and we are making solid progress on it.
I just second the question.
To repeat, if you would, where it came from? I didn't hear that part.
Pardon me?
Where did the grant come from? I didn't
the
hear
the BUILD initiative.
Thank you.
So how would you incentivize quality child care?
So it's a ranking system. So if you're a child care provider and you want to be a 4-star, there are it's aspirational, basically. If you want to be the a destination child care provider, that's sort of you can aim for that, or you can aim for a 3 or a 2 or 1. 1 would just be licensure, so that's still a good place. That's a fine place to have kids, but the idea is that we create incentives for improving quality, but also give parents a better way to evaluate settings for their children than we currently have now across the settings that stay licenses.
The goals to get
those are still underway. Those are still being developed.
When will that be ready? When will that process start?
The fall. Yeah. For sort of piloting it, I think we'll have a draft and be ready to move that forward. This is the system and everybody's going to use it.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Duke, on the next steps on the TQRIS, the bill required approval from the Early Learning Council. At what meeting is that going to come to the council?
Co-Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, of a final TQRIS, probably in November.
And tell us what TQRS.
Tiered Quality Rating and Improvement System.
Follow up? Thank you, Madam Chair. So the approval from the ELC will happen in November. I assume no pilots will happen until there's approval of the overall criteria for the system.
Co-Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, that's correct. So the Early Learning Council is getting progress updates on the work that's being done right now. So we have there's an Early Learning Council meeting tomorrow, and we'll walk through with the work that's being done so far. But you're correct that nothing will get done before the statutory required approval of the Early Learning Council.
Follow? Could we, in the group that's working on that at employment in the child care division, is there an internal work group? Is there a stakeholder work group? I'm looking on your website. Right. I didn't see it, but I could be missing it.
So there's an internal work group that is, pardon me, Co-Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek. There are a bunch of people working on it. So there's the internal staff group that is folks you know. So Kara Waddell, Heidi McGowan, and other folks internally. We're also, the Early Learning Council is convening a child care and an early education work group that will be sort of an ongoing advisory committee to help with this. And they have convened at the child care division an advisory group. I don't have the names with me of people that are specifically helping with this TQRIS process.
Sorry. Is that somewhere on the website where it actually lays out the process? The reason I'm asking is, sure, I do think there are concerns out there to making sure that the quality rating system encompasses the full diversity of child care options out there, understanding the incentives. I think it's an important foundational piece as we move forward, but I think there are a lot of folks who want to make sure if they're not in that work group, they know where it's happening prior to the November discussion in the ELC. So I just want to make sure it's clear where people can jump in on that conversation if they want. And that's all. If there's a place to look, that's fine. You can send it to me, and that'd be helpful.
This would be that's all helpful. This would be a good time for me to point out that we are also working to improve our web presence because it's a little clunky right now. So that is something that's not on the list. But Representative Kotek, I'll get you more and all of you more details on the work plan for TQRS. I'm a little behind because the real experts on it are going to be reporting to the Early Learning Council tomorrow, and I don't want to get ahead of them.
And send it to the whole committee, would you please? Because I think there are other people who are interested in that. Thank you.
Of course.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Of course. The biggest key deliverable in this legislation for the next session is the community-based coordinators of early learning services, formerly known as the hubs. These would be the coordinated bodies around the state that will be focused on getting results from a variety of programs that the state funds, the communities fund, and hopefully to build this new partnership around the state to deliver outcomes for kids. And particularly noteworthy, the local commissions on children and families go away in a year, June 30th, 2013. And these community-based coordinators are not able to start up later than January 1, 2014. So the requirement in legislation is to come back to the legislature with the components of a potential RFP for the legislature to approve before any implementation can happen. And so the Early Learning Council tomorrow will approve the work group that will, it will be chaired by Charles McGee, who's a member of the Early Learning Council, be people from all over the state, who will investigate the criteria and determine the criteria to bring to you by February of 2013. And I think I handed out to you the charge that we've given the work group, which is directly lifted from statute. This is the one of all the work in statute, the reports to come back. This is the one that is the most detailed. And in terms of what the council has to consider and bring back to you and the questions that have to be asked, they certainly may suggest additional things, but the basics that are required are quite detailed.
Madam Chair.
No, Representative Greenleg.
This has been a sort of astronomical day. I mean, we spent the morning talking about transformation and the health and change, and now we're talking about the extraordinary kind of transformation this is representing, which is a small piece of the educational reform. Is this sucker going to fly? What's your assessment of the risks around this and the extent to which you think it's going to go where it needs to go to achieve what we want it to achieve?
Co-Chairs Tomei and Gilliam, Representative Greenleg, I think the prospects are very good. It's high risk in the same way healthcare transformation was high risk. I think the risks are somewhat different in that there isn't the heavy weight of Medicaid-driven budget issues driving this whole thing. It's more about doing better with what we have and finding ways to then invest more. But I think it will fly. I think what has been surprising and exciting is since this all started, since some of my first meetings were going to groups saying the governor's proposal is that your group doesn't exist anymore, that went remarkably well, actually. I tried to say it more artfully than that. But that communities all over Oregon are eager to do things differently and better. Now, we will all differ on what some of the details are, but which isn't to say there isn't nervousness or that there aren't components of the legislation or the governor's vision that not everybody's bought into. But I think the likelihood that this completely fails is pretty low. I think if nothing happened, you're basically left with what you've got. You've had in statute for well over 10 years aspirational goals about an early childhood system that's even named an early childhood system in statute and isn't one. So the worst thing that can happen is you have the status quo. I doubt it could get worse in terms of the outcomes and our inability to connect the systems. I really do think that communities are actually further ahead in some communities than the Early Learning Council is in thinking about how to do this. People have taken this legislation and really started asking themselves tough questions and trying to forge new partnerships in different parts of the state. Now, some people are further ahead than others, but it's been remarkable for me to go to communities and basically be told, we're ready to go. Let's help us fill in the details because we want to act.
It's very optimistic. That sounds good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Oh, no. Representative,
I have more.
Go ahead.
I don't want to interrupt this flow.
No, go ahead.
Duke, I'm looking on your agenda for tomorrow. At the ELC, I see you're in Burns. Or somewhere. You're out in Eastern Oregon.
Co-chairs, Representative Kotek, I will be driving to Burns tonight.
Which is awesome. My question is, on the work groups, so you have a series of work groups.
Mm-hmm.
It's unclear from the agenda that there's an action item here. So you're going to be approving work group members. Are those proposed work group members posted anywhere?
Co-chairs, Representative Kotek, they will be posted. They are not yet.
Okay. Because there's 6 work groups? 5 work groups?
Co-chairs, Representative Kotek, yes, that sounds right.
And Madam Chair?
I will tell you, for example, we're still adding members, which is why it's not finalized. We added one today from the governor's office, someone who we want to recommend to the council.
Okay. And then the discussion around the Youth Development Council? I don't see it on the agenda. Is it?
Co-chairs, Representative Kotek. Other than I will provide a briefing on the transition plans from the commission to the Early Learning Council, but the Youth Development Council is kind of going to be its own thing, and I haven't really, other than separating the early learning pieces to the Early Learning Council, kind of keeping that on its own track from the Early Learning Council.
My apologies. That makes sense. Is the OEIB approving the Youth Development Council? I'm just looking at the whole of the bill that we passed last session and making sure that all the parts are happening. And I'll admit I have not been tracking as closely. I've got a few other things going on. But I'm a little... We have a lot of product that has to happen in the fall. We have work groups being formed. You have a very ambitious timeline. And you don't have an early learning coordinator yet. I want to make sure we're going to hit our targets.
Co-chairs, Representative Kotek, as you know, I share your anxiety about many things. The timeline is aggressive, but it's also what was put into the bill. So these are not optional. We will get them done.
We're listening to the last conversation. There you go. They're not optional.
Well, this is what we set up in February. So, yes, the Youth Development Council progress will be reported to OEIB and is being reported to the governor. Just structurally, I'll tell you, we're working right now on all the pieces of breaking apart which staff go where, we're going to house them all, how the budgets transfer, the sort of the inside operational machinery. That is actually going very well. So the part that is highest risk that somehow the I's won't get dotted or T's crossed on the ongoing business operations of the leftover components of the State Commission and then the ongoing duties and stewardship of the State Commission system, the local commission system, that's going to be rock solid. That's the developmental pieces. You're right. We don't have a system director yet, but we're working on bringing on a lot of consulting help with the ARRA funds that we have. So we're still looking for the director, but I think I've heard from you and others loud and clear about our lack of horsepower, and so we are addressing that. Perhaps not sufficiently.
I don't want to dominate the conversation. I just, you know I worked on the bill, so I'll, you know.
I know, that's...
I appreciate the indulgence in the conversation, so...
Yeah. Thank you, Duke. Go ahead.
Okay. I do have a piece of good news, which is, well, this is all, I think, good news because we are making progress, but after you adjourned, we were notified by the federal government that they would be doing another Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge process. You may recall that we came in 13th last time, and they funded 9. So two things happened. They went back and looked at the scores, and it turns out we actually came in 12th. That wouldn't really matter to me, except they decided to then go ahead and fund the next 5. And so we have been invited to reapply, which will mean for half of the eligible amount. So last time we were invited to apply for $50 million, we applied for 40.6. We will have the ability to reapply for $25 million. And by reapply, that will mean update our application. That will not, this is not a whole new open it up, compete cycle. We are going to be Race to the Top winners. I cannot tell you, I think it's up to us whether we position ourselves to be funded at $1 million or $25 million. That's about the quality of our application and what we do. Although I do think with everything that some of the components I've described to you already came out of the grant application, the fact that we've already moved on them, that the legislature adopted them widely, and that we're making progress on them, we could almost just staple the bill to our application and say, here we go, we're ready, but we'll do it a little more artfully than that. That process won't be complete until December, though. But I'll be happy to keep you informed as that happens. We'll probably have to do the actual resubmittal in the fall, and the grant will be awarded in December.
Informed. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Duke, I don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth, but can you just briefly describe what is it that precipitates reviewing our score and expanding the number?
Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, so a couple of things happened. They went back and looked at a couple of how the reviewers looked at other states' applications and adjusted some other states' scores and dropped them below us. Nothing changed in our scores. And then what precipitated it, the federal government, the Obama administration, was looking at doing a third round of Race to the Top and had largely talked about doing it focused on school districts. And there was honestly a huge outcry across the country for more investment in early childhood because there were so few states that were funded. And that produced this next round. And they considered doing a whole new process, but then looked, and ours and the other five were clearly the highest next tier. And so just simplified it by setting up a reapplication process.
Good. Okay, proceed.
Some of the other deliverables in 4165 is a joint planning process with the State Interagency Council on Early Intervention and Early Childhood Special Education. That interagency council has recently met, has provided to the chair of the Early Learning Council and to me their recommendations for the scope of work and the process, and we're going to work to integrate that with all these other work groups that you have and knock out that work by September as well. An additional work group is on screening. We have had in statute for well over a decade the aspiration of common screening for risk factors in publicly funded settings, and we are going to finally round the corner on this and come to some decisions about the best screening tools to use in the settings that are going to give us the best information on how to reach kids. We have a big work group that met for the first time today, chaired by Janet Doherty Smith, who is a member of the Early Learning Council, a retired special education, early intervention, and a Head Start leader. And they have the work products from previous work groups that they're going to bring to the Early Learning Council for their decision again in the fall. Sorry, I saw you move over there. In terms of healthcare, this is not required in the legislation, but it's kind of required by common sense and the momentum in this state, which is we're working with the Health Policy Board and the Early Learning Council to figure out how and where this effort overlaps and connects to a health transformation on the Medicaid side. We, as I've said before, we don't want to work to break down all these silos and then create two new giant ones. So just trying to be smart about doing this. That doesn't have a work plan yet or anything other than us continuing to be intentional about making sure we stay connected from early learning to healthcare so that we don't grow these apart or duplicate services. We should get a lot more efficient with both of these.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
It's really important, and I think we both hope to keep the healthcare committee informed about it. There's no question that a healthy child is going to learn better than a child that's not healthy, and that's very important. It's been very hard to get the current education department to create a policy on the health of children. I mean, somewhere along the line, it would be very useful if this process produced something like that, so we could have something to measure progress against. And it's been very frustrating to me personally that we can't think about health of children in the context of learning, because that's where you need to think about it. I hope this is something you keep on your list of to-do things.
Co-chairs, Representative Greenlick, it definitely is. I think it's an interesting conversation when we are on the education side. Early learning is more than traditional education defined, but talking about we're talking about health, and on health side, we're asking if they talk about education. So trying to bring those together is something that is, I think, an expected outcome of what we're going to deliver.
Well, autism is the perfect example. If I continue, I mean, we've tried very hard to create that link between health and education, dealing with early diagnosis and services for autism, because the autism tsunami is going to overcome everything that you do if we're not dealing with it in the way that we can. Glad to hear that, Duke. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Cotter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Duke, have you formalized this discussion with in the CCO? Again, not totally tracking all the CCO outcome measurements, but I would assume if the focus is on 0 to 5, that if you're serving a child in that age range on that Oregon Health Plan, you're a CCO, you will have certain goals you have to meet. Is that the general sense of how that's going to go, and so we'll be able to quantify if they are actually meeting the goals for that age range?
I don't think those are in the criterion for the CCOs.
I didn't think so either, but I just thought maybe I might have not seen them. So,
co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, Representative Kotek, I think we aspire to having those criteria over time. We're definitely, that's why we're having this conversation with the Health Policy Board, is to figure out how to weave those in as we build these systems almost on parallel tracks.
Okay.
I mean, we did talk early on about kindergarten readiness and having that as part of the criteria. You know, some of my colleagues and I, and how would we do that? Now, we're not ready for that because we're not even ready on the kindergarten readiness as an outcome on the early learning side, let alone figuring out how to build that into the health world. But that's going to continue to be part of what we're pursuing.
And maybe I just have a...
And I'm not a health person, you know.
Is every child getting a WELVIS? Is every child, you know, hitting all their markers for developmental assessments? You know, if we could just do that, I think then we get to the, you know, we contribute to the kindergarten readiness through, you know, health screenings, health assessments, health monitoring, you know, until they even get to kindergarten. So, I think as the CCOs get up, it's a little hard right now to pile on too much, but I think... Hopefully by next year we'll be having this conversation that that is our anticipation for the next round of contracting for CCOs to have that part of their goals. It would seem silly not to be very much more specific about what we're expecting of them as we move forward with the community-based organizations on early learning as well. So just something for the next.
Co-chairs, Representative Kotek, I think, I mean, that's a perfect way to connect to the screening group that I mentioned. If we make the determinations on what are the best screenings to use, and the Early Learning Council sets that up on the early learning side, and then the health system picks that up in the next round, as you had said, then we get to that consistency across systems and are able to capture that and use it.
Thanks.
Anything else?
Co-chairs, none from me. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Duke. Any questions, Duke, before we say adieu? All right. Thank you so
Thanks
much.
For your time.
Thank you, Representative Kotek,
you,
for joining us, asking great questions. Anything
Chair,
to the good of the order?
Madam Chair, I think although it was nice to have Representative Kotek here, I think we remember now why we put her off the committee. She, she just dominates the whole
thing. I know. Yeah. Such a bore.
Yes. Thank you all. Anything for the good of the order? If not, we will close the Human Services Committee. And see you guys in September, isn't that right?
Yep.
All right, thank you so much.